Is the box heavy today?
Not a bit.
Ah, thank you. People are very kind. Excellent. Oh, hey. That's pretty good. Wow, this is all we've got for today. You must all be very in line. This is yesterday's questions. My goodness. Okay, let's get these ones done first of all. Last night. Oops. Here we go. When we lose control and the body takes care of itself, oh yes, what kind of things can happen besides the ones you have mentioned about the back bending and straightening by itself? For example, once my neck ever move, eh? Once my neck ever move by itself, or if I am chiropractic myself, it reacts amazing afterwards. Not quite sure what you're saying there, but anyway, just when you do lose control of the body, you are losing control of it. But the body actually takes over, and the body just actually knows kind of what to do for itself. You know, all the years I've been alive, I've never told my liver what to do. And it works all the time by itself, and it's done a pretty good job so far. Have you ever tried to control your liver? The body is kind of designed to be automatic. It does it really, 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 really well. And when we get involved in stuff, that's when we usually mess around and spoil things. Because I think a lot of times that people either were stupid or they were just too busy or they weren't paying attention, and the body did fine. But then we get this idea that we can control things like driving a car. So it's wonderful that we can just let go. And all sorts of amazing things happen. I was saying about this guy in Penang who came to see me, and he had this very weird disease, something about his brain, and sometimes the synapses or something were all scrambled. And it was such a weird disease, I think it's only about 5 or 6, 7, 8, 9 or something people in the whole world had this. And the experts for this disease just happened to be in Singapore. So they gave him the ECG, or the EEG, sorry, and they sort of saw the problem, and they said, well, the solution is actually an operation, but it's quite painful because he couldn't do it under anesthesia. They open up his skull, and then they mess around with his brain inside. And he thought, do I really need to do this? It was only because he just got married and he thought it was not fair on his wife that he would die so young. So he went ahead with it, and he said, you know, really painful, but, you know, it did it. And he recovered, and so all was well. But then it came back again. And, you know, it's extremely rare that this disease would return. And so that he came up to see me in Penang, and he said, what should I do? And it was really unpleasant and painful, but his wife was pregnant with his first child. And he said, well, now the timing of this disease is awful. Now, I can't leave my wife. You know, now she's pregnant with my first child. I can't let her, you know, not have a partner to help bring up my first child. So he asked me what he could do. And then I said, well, look, you know, you have to try some meditation. And when you get deep in meditation, be really peaceful and just send some good energy up to your brain. And so he tried that. But then, you know, it wasn't really working, so he had to go off to the hospital in Singapore, you know, quite expensive as well as painful, and just to get ready for the next operation. and he wasn't looking forward to it at all. And he told me what happened. They did him the pre-operation, preparation, and they had to put this like frame around his skull, which was very unpleasant to stop him sort of interfering with the operation. And they, you know, took the another EEG to make sure that they know exactly what was happening. And that's when he said he was wearing the frame, being ready to be operated on. And then the doctors said, oh, I think we need to take the EEG again. Not the EEG, the brain scan, whatever. We need to take the brain scan again. There's something wrong with the machine. And that's a wonderful thing if ever that happens to you. If the doctors say there's something wrong with the machine, say yes. So they gave him another brain scan and they took the frame off his head and said, we don't need to do any operation. Don't know what's going on, but the thing has corrected itself. You know, the brain is just now properly sort of organized. And that's when he came to thank me afterwards. There's a really unpleasant operation I was about to face, but I'm not quite sure exactly what had happened, but the meditation meant I didn't need to go through that pain. So thank you. So those are the other things which happen sometimes. Doctors don't know what's going on or why it happens, but a lot of time, if you can relax that part of your body, the body heals itself in a weird, weird way. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I'm trying and failing to find metta in my heart for someone. Oh, never mind. If you can't give metta to anybody else, give it to yourself. Then it doesn't matter, you're not failing at all. When I try to think of good qualities, my imagination does me no good whatsoever. Unfortunately, I'm related to this person. I feel an obligation to avoid ill will towards him. Should I strive to practice compassion instead of metta? Well, if you really know what metta is just this unconditional acceptance. You know, the door of my heart is open to you. It doesn't mean I like you. It doesn't mean the door of the heart is just to come in. The doors in your heart are also to go out as well. But in other words, you're at peace, you know, with your emotional reaction to that person. So make peace with those reactions, first of all. Don't try to get rid of them. If you try to get rid of those reactions, you make them worse. That is like just telling the anger-eating monster to get out of here, you don't belong. So first of all, make peace with those negative emotions towards somebody. There's some sort of reason behind them. And so be kind to your reactions to that person. And once you're kind to the reactions, it's not such a far step than to be kind to them as well. But you can't rush it. These things just have to grow. And the more you try and put fast fertilizer on these changing of your reaction from ill will to metta, the more you try and rush it, the worse it gets. So just let it go slowly. Dear teacher, during meditation or nimitta, can a meditator be possessed by devas or spirits? No, they can't. And the reason I say that is because you are too virtuous. That is what stops devas or spirits even getting close to you. One of these stories, to make a point, there was this Thai lady here in Perth many years ago, and she was really a hard worker, an excellent mother. She had these four kids, and they all sort of, to this day, they look after one another. They always come and see me and whenever they're in town. And she invited her mother over from Thailand because no one was looking after her mother. So her mother came. And when her mother was here, she was much older, obviously. And, of course, she has to be, hasn't she? But nevertheless, Sometimes I say some silly things. And anyway, that she got ill, so that she went into like the hospital, and the, was it King Edward Hospital for Women or something? But anyway, in the Thai tradition, if your mother is in a hospital and it's at all possible for you, you just camp out next to your mother's bed in the hospital. The amount of sort of care which you give to a mother is really amazing. They don't leave her side, almost. So anyway, she was looking after her mother, and the mother wasn't making any sort of progress, getting more healthy. And so after a time, this Thai lady just kind of wondered, I wonder if this is my mother's last illness. And she didn't trust the doctors. So she went to a medium in Perth. And it was not expensive at that time. She paid $20 for this medium. And this medium, she was quite well known and very quite trustworthy. And the medium said, like a spirit doctor, this medium said, all I need to do is to know your mother's name, the hospital, the ward number and her room. And I'll go in there and check her out and see just how her illness is, see whether it's her last illness or not. So this Thai lady gave her $20 to the medium, and then the medium just went into a trance, went unconscious. And about 10 minutes later, she came back, and the medium said to this Thai girl, here's your $20 back. And the Thai lady, couldn't you find my mother? And she said, yes, I found the hospital, I found the ward number, I found the room, but I could not get inside the room. I've never seen this before. There was like a force field around your mother. And I couldn't get in to see, you know, exactly what a sickness is and how it's progressing. That's why I gave you the $20 back. Who is your mum? And that's when the Thai lady said, oh, she's an eight-precept nun. She's been an eight-precept nun for years. And that's when the medium grabbed the $20 back and said, you should have told me. People like me can't get close to people like that. And she took the $20 back, wasting her time. But, you know, that was like quite an honest medium. And that's just an example of many you've gathered over all these years. You know, if you've got your precepts very strong, then any spirits and stuff, they can't even get close to you to get inside of you. So over here, you're perfectly safe. But the only spirit that can possess you, actually, I was wrong there. There is one type of spirit which can possess you, even if you have to break your precepts to be possessed by this spirit. This spirit is called the... You know what my story is. It's called the bottle ghost. It lives in bottles of whiskey and gin, and they're very dangerous. And you just open the top of the bottle and drink a little bit, and it possesses you. You can't even speak in a normal language. And that's actually why they call. What do they call whiskey and rum and vodka and stuff? What do they call them? They call them spirits. Do you ever wonder why they called them spirits? Now you know, they possess you. Okay, anyway. Many Southeast Asian countries believe in medium that represent devas or spirits or relatives that can speak or give advice to humans. Thank you. Not the devas. The devas are way too high to actually to possess anybody. They don't need to actually to go through a medium to speak to people. They've got enough power, they can let you know by themselves. Dear teacher, can you please describe the bliss during Nimitta? It sounds already shut off, or is it at a reduced volume? How about a hissing sound that is heavenly and continue? Oh, I don't know what that says. Please, if you can write clearly. But the bliss during Nimitta is It's very beautiful. It's delightful. It's not small, but it's, oh, this is nice. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, give me more of this. Wow. It really is sort of, no, not sort of, but almost like tangible. It feels great. So this is what happens during nimitta. And it sounds already shut off. It's at a reduced volume. It's like the sound can disturb the nimitta, like it's at a hearing something a long distance away, or you can maybe hear it and then it just disappears again almost immediately, because you know it can't grab your attention anymore. The nimitta is more beautiful, more delightful. So anyway, when you see these beautiful lights in the mind and it's a different colour than anything you've seen in the real world, then you sort of know these are nimittas, and it's always really, really pleasant. A lot of piti sukha, a lot of joy. What physic powers do you have? I've got a couple of degrees in physics. I think you misspelt this, you meant psychic powers. Do you want to know what psychic powers I have? Am I allowed to tell you? You can guess from this story which psychic powers I have. Because when Ajahn Chah passed away, at his funeral service, they had the TV cameras were there, and they did an interview with, I think, three or four monks, together with one of the senior lay supporters. And that's the question they asked them. Have you seen Ajahn Chah perform any psychic powers? If so, which ones? And then all the monks were quiet. And the lay person said, I've seen Ajahn Chah perform psychic powers. And all the monks also were interested. What did you see? And then the layperson said, I saw Ajahn Chah teach the Dhamma to so many thousands of people. And if you look at all the psychic powers, the Buddha said that's the only psychic power he recommends and supports and praises, the ability to teach so many other thousands of people. So have you seen me do psychic powers? But that's not the sort of thing you like, is it? You want something a bit more like from Disney or something. But this is one of the reasons why monks or nuns who have psychic powers would never show them in public. There was this one monk, I've mentioned him before, I don't know if any of you have ever met him. His name was, I think, Sudamo. He was Indonesian. And his story was that as a young man, you know, he wanted to leave the world, so he went into the jungles in Java. And in those jungles, he found a nice quiet place to meditate. He sat down, and this is what he said to me personally, you know, because you know, I met him and I just... He was a very powerful monk and I just wanted to find out his story. So he was meditating in the jungle and just he was closed his eyes and he saw this. This is how he described it. It's easy to interpret. He saw this star, this heavenly being star, just like an angel, just come into his mind. And when he described it, it was using the best English he could to say, as a nimitta came into his meditation. And he said he married that star. I liked his choice of language, to marry it. That was how he emotionally experienced it and interpreted it. He united with it, he went right inside of it. And then when he came out of that meditation, he didn't know how much time had went past, he didn't have any watches, it was in the jungle. But he noticed the area where he was meditating seemed to have changed from the time he actually sat down there first of all. And he checked with the village afterwards, and they were just so surprised that, is that where you were meditating? He said, yeah. And he said there was a huge flood there. Where he was meditating, many of the trees had been damaged by that flood. And that's why it looked totally different. And when they saw where he was meditating, he said, you were underwater for days. He never knew anything about that. That's typical when you get into these deep meditations. Your body is just protected, even though you're underwater, you don't need to breathe. And he obviously survived that. And that was the kind of meditation he got into. And so number two, look, that means when you fly home, if the flight is about to crash and go into the sea, just get into jhana quickly. And then you'll be safe. But anyway, he was a very powerful monk. And later on, we actually ordained afterwards, later on, he was teaching some meditation once a week, every Saturday afternoon, in Wat Bawon. That's a big monastery in central Bangkok. And one of my friends, she was a Thai princess, but the Thai princesses, she was like a granddaughter of one of the old kings. And, she was a good friend. And because her husband went to the same school as me, but a few years before me. And so, teacher and disciple, but just friends. And she told me that when she went to this meditation class, that during this sitting, when everyone was supposed to have their eyes closed, she felt that something weird was going on in the room. And I say this because she would not lie to me. And she said, this is absolutely true, I'm not exaggerating. Something weird was going on. I felt that something was not quite usual. I opened my eyes. Did you ever meet Sudama, the monk? Okay. She opened her eyes, and there was rays of light coming out from this monk's eyes, going into one of the other meditators' bodies. And this was real. It wasn't like just watching some movie of some superhero. This was a real monk with laser eyes coming out into somebody else's body. Would you like to see that? You may imagine yes, but the answer really is no. She was a powerful, a very well-educated woman. But then when she saw that, she got up and left and never went back. The real result of seeing psychic powers, it scares everything out of you. It's something you don't understand, it's something which is powerful. That's one of the reasons why good nuns don't show them, even though they may have them. Anyway, next question. I have not been meditating too long, but since I have, my dreams are becoming very vivid. And in a certain order. One, aggression, anger and violence. Two, confusion. Three, sensual. Is there any meaning to this? Well, it's exciting. But it's the wrong time to be excited when you want to go to sleep. So you haven't been meditating too long. Sometimes they're very vivid in a certain order. After a while, they'll just vanish and disappear. If you want to get them to vanish and disappear earlier, then when you tuck yourself into bed at night, you don't just go to sleep. You actually do some either determinations, may I have a peaceful sleep, may I have a peaceful sleep, may I have a peaceful sleep. Or as the Buddha suggested, do a little bit of loving-kindness meditation. May all beings be happy and well. May all beings in my cottage have a nice sleep and be safe. May all beings in the whole of jhana grove become peaceful, get beautiful nimittas and jhanas and enlightenment. May they be healthy, may all their aspirations be met. when you spread loving kindness like that, and all the birds in the trees, all the little bugs in the soil, may all beings throughout this whole area be happy and well. If you do the loving kindness, even simple, just a few words, then that would usually protect you from bad dreams. Easily. It's not hard to do that. But you know, a lot of times the people, when they're in a retreat, there's nothing much to excite you except Ajahn Brahm's stupid jokes. So because of that, sometimes you feel, well, maybe I'll just have a little bit of aggression, anger, violent dreams, and then confusion, and then some sensual ones. Because you don't have any internet, you don't have any TV. I couldn't understand why people just... Sometimes they used to go to cinemas to watch horror movies. Isn't life horrible enough? Or they go on these... They're supposed to be fun parks and go on these bungee jumps or death jumps. I've never been on a bungee jump, but I remember when they first came out, I would just park in the car next to one of these parks and just watch people do bungee jumps. Who would ever want to do that? You have to pay for it as well. That's crazy to me. How many people have ever been on a bungee jump? Only two. Oh, my goodness. Were you scared?
Yes.
Yeah, what'd you do it for? Anyway. That's actually a good question. Why is it that people like to be scared? Why is it like to see, like, horror movies? You know, like, vampires and, yeah.
Because they're close to the moment.
Close to the moment. There's much better ways of being close to the moment. Much more enjoyable, blissing out. But yeah, what you say is probably true. Anyway, dear Ajahn, why I hear loud heartbeat at the beginning of meditation? Oh, that's just because there's excitement, joy or whatever, and mostly excitement. Now, why is it that you're maybe just going out with somebody when you weren't looking for a partner in life, and you get a big heartbeat when you see someone you really like and they're going out with you? Why is it you get a big heartbeat when you go to a concert, you see some famous person? Why is it all this? A member of our Buddhist society years ago, she wanted to go and see His Holiness the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala in India. And she was, I think, our deputy president of our Buddhist society in Western Australia. So she used that to get sort of like an interview, an appointment with the Dalai Lama. She said, I'm the deputy president of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. We were very small in those days. But they didn't know that. So she got an appointment in a couple of days' time. She had a couple of days to wait. And so she would go and meditate every morning in the meditation hall. She liked her meditation. She was a good Buddhist. And then one morning she told me she got up early, went into the meditation hall, was sitting down quietly meditating, and somebody came and sat next to her and made a little bit of noise. And then she was a bit disturbed by the noise. But anyway, she looked at that person and that was the end of her meditation. It was Richard Gere. And she tried... She tried to sort of, you know, turn around and just watch her breath, but then, no, Richard Gere's next to me. It totally destroyed her meditation. You know, it's also that there's quite a few famous people who like to meditate, and even like supermodels. Kate Moss. I've never seen her, but she's supposed to be a supermodel. But anyway, that this friend of mine who went on one of these retreats and heard that Kate Moss was attending that retreat. And he couldn't help himself, you know, like when the retreat started, he looked around, which one is Kate Moss? This supermodel. And he couldn't locate her. She's on that retreat. And he saw her later. But the amazing thing was Kate Moss, the model, you only notice her because there's so much makeup, clothes, airbrushing, and everything is set up for her to look beautiful. In real life, she was like plain. It was like this canvas which the makeup artists and the hairstylers could, it's so plain that you could make up whatever you wanted on it. There's a wonderful little reflection he had on that. So a couple of times on my retreats we've had famous people on the retreat. And the only way I knew that was there was one of the retreats we did at, before this retreat place was opened up in North Perth. And I noticed that all these young Thai men were on this retreat, and they never, it's even hard to get them to come to the Waisak ceremony. But they're all on this retreat. And I asked the organisers, why? She said, that lady over there, she was a famous Thai film actress. And, she only does Thai films, so people in Australia didn't know her. And so she came to Perth because she thought that way she can get some peace and quiet and go on a nice retreat without anybody recognising her. It didn't work because the word went around and all these Thai men were coming there on this retreat. I don't know if they meditated very much. They had their eyes open a lot. Anyway, dear Ajahn Brahm. The loud heartbeat at the beginning of meditation. If that happens, then just at the beginning of meditation, say to your heart, I open my heart to the sound of my heart. You open the door of your heart to your door of your heart. And so what actually happens? You don't fight it, it's just a little habit which happens, and then you just, the heartbeat will relax by itself usually. I try to relax and breathe as usual, but the will to notice the breath is strong. What should I do? Where should I focus on the breath? Sometimes I feel sensation on the nostrils, inside the nose, and sound of the breath. It is not a subtle breath. Could you go to the breath too soon? So one of the things which I suggested to you, just go into your body first of all, do a body scan. How are you sitting? Are you comfortable? And after a while you get so sensitive to the feelings and sensations in your body, it's fascinating just how you can relax all the different parts of your body and get really sensitive to them. And that also means that, like a monk's digestive system, a nun's too, sometimes we have a problem with digestion because, we don't really choose the food which we have. It's only got to choose from what's actually presented, and sometimes there's nothing there which I'm used to. So nevertheless, you can actually scan your body, and especially the digestive tract, and just relax everything. It's amazing just how often that's been incredibly beneficial to me. I think the first day tell the story of the food poisoning. It's just not food poisoning. It's just all this other stuff which, sometimes you get. And I've had not just diarrhea but dysentery. And, in Thailand, because you don't know really what's in the food. And I've already mentioned some of the disgusting food. I was told, don't ask what's in the food. If you tell you, you lose your hunger. There's snails and all sorts of ants' eggs. And ants. What else do we have? Oh, the frogs. The frog story. We'd only eat one meal a day. Those days. And he had enough rice on the arms round. But that day there was nothing else. No fruit was offered. And sometimes in the seasons you can have a banana or a mango seasons, you had a lovely time because lots of mangoes and that went very well with rice, sticky rice. But anyway, this day we had our rice and the only other thing we had, the villagers were struggling to get anything to eat. And the night before, you could hear the first rains had come, and so they were out at night catching frogs. And those frogs were what they offered to the monks the next day. And these were, it's not like well-cooked frogs. It's not like they added any season like garlic or chili or salt or soy sauce or anything. It was boiled frogs. Just like the frog had hopped into the boiling water. Not seasoned at all. And from there, hopped into your plate. Not a plate, in the bowl. So you can imagine, the one meal of the day, you had this ball of sticky rice about this big. And on top of that ball of sticky rice, I see no exaggeration, a frog, no, quite a big one, not a tiny one. That was your one meal of the day. So, you know, you didn't have any choice, so you had to eat that. No vegetables, nothing, just frog and rice. Boiled frog and rice, sorry. And that was, I tell this story, so especially to parents whose children are too lazy at school to pay attention. As you know, I paid attention to science, especially biology. I knew one part of a frog from the other. So, you know, usually if you're going to eat a frog, you start with its, you know, the meat on its legs. That's not kind of like chicken. There's not much of it. And then, of course, you need some more sustenance, so you start in its innards, its organs. And that's when the monk sitting next to me, this is not an exaggeration. The monk sitting next to me, obviously he didn't study well at school. Because he pressed this part of a frog called the bladder. It still had urine in it. And that frog peed all over his rice. Honest. It didn't matter how hungry he was, he couldn't eat after that. That's the sort of thing we have to do. But at least I knew I had a good story to tell people later on in my life. The worst food, though, was not the frog. It never happened to me, they never gave me this, but I know this one area, it was a very rough area. And a special, like, tribe of people there. And one day he had his rice, and then the person put into his bowl a bat's head. Exactly. And he closed off his bowl lid, and he walked back, what am I going to do with this? And when he sat down, he looked at that. He fasted that day. He says it's the most, one of the most ugly things to actually to see. You know, bat's head, and that was his food for the day: bat's head and rice. Oh, no, I shouldn't get into this. So I don't get onto this anyway. Anyway, oh yeah, just that when you are aware of your body, you find it's amazing just how you can heal things, and you can actually make your physical health much better and relieve so much of the pain or the aches in the body. So that's one of the reasons why it's great to start the meditation with awareness on the body. Relax it really deeply. And if it does perform these two services. Number one, it increases your mindfulness, and the mindfulness gets more powerful. And just things in the body are always, in the present moment. So you're not really looking at the past or the future. And number two, it's easy to watch experiences in your body. And it's to relax them, you just need to put this kindness in. And this is where you also learn what kindness is. And I just say, my knee's hurting, I just watch the knee. Be really kind to it, don't touch it. And learn how to relax it, sort of open it up, lessen any tension anywhere. And you know if it's happening, if you're getting easier feelings in your knee, you know, the pain starts to disappear, gets less and less and less. You realize that was kindness you gave. It's very difficult, even like Buddhists are supposed to be very strong on kindness. We practice loving kindness, but are we? And sometimes we think we are, but we assume we know kindness. Kindness is not just chanting, may all beings be happy and well, may all beings be free of suffering. That's a mosquito. May all beings... You see people do that. You know, they know the chant, but they don't know what loving kindness is. So anyway, when you have the kindness, then the body really relaxes. And then you don't go looking for your breath, you wait for the breath to come to you. And just those guided meditations which I give online, it just, next thing I ask is, how peaceful am I? And when I teach that, give it a number from 1 to 10. 1 is really peaceful, 10 is really agitated. Just be aware of your level of peace. All that serves to do is just to start noticing peace. It's one of the things in your mind. And after a while, you know what peace is. You can feel it, recognize it. And then you just manage to, what's the cause of peace? Peace is so attractive when you know what it is. It leads you into being in the present moment. That's where peace lies. In the past, it's all those things which you are ashamed of, all those bad memories, what other people did to you. There's so much busyness in the past. And in the future, that's where all the plans go. Imagine you don't have any future. How can you want anything? Wanting needs a place to land in the future somewhere. And if the future perception is just not there for you, you're in this moment and the future has kind of disappeared, then all wanting just has got no place to go. Become peaceful. When those coarser form of the hindrances are gone, the mindfulness is strong enough, and it's so easy to watch your breathing. You don't try to watch the breathing, there's still too many hindrances there. You just calm yourself down, relax the body, mindfulness and kindness, and soon that mindfulness is so strong, the hindrances are just already weak. And then you can watch your breath, which is so easy. Number 2, where do you watch the breath? Wherever the breath happens to be. I had this little interview session with somebody, and I mentioned to them that when I was, all the time, I suffer from hay fever, there's some allergies, which I still have, because my father had asthma. And I didn't get asthma, but I still am allergic to many things. And during the flower season, I have hay fever, even in the UK. So what happened to me, that some time of the year, I could not breathe through my nose. It was blocked. And so, you know, when the teacher said, yeah, watch the breath at the tip of your nose, I said, nothing's happening there. My nose is blocked. I'm watching it through my mouth. Could I still meditate? At first I thought, maybe I can't meditate when I've got hay fever and my nose gets blocked. But then I thought, I can still breathe. Where am I breathing? If I can breathe, I can watch the breath. I stopped even trying to watch it at the tip of my nose. I watch it anywhere. Wherever that breath happens to be, that's where I watch it. And that was a huge advantage to me. I never even looked at my nose. All I did was the breath going in or breath going out. How do I know that? Whatever that feeling was, wherever it was located, that's what I focused on. It's so much easier. Even for those who haven't got blocked noses, you watch the tip of the nose, you can't find the breath because the breath's not there. It's somewhere else. So you're looking for the breath in a place where it isn't. No wonder you can't meditate. But then when you start just watching the breathing, wherever it happens to be, it's so much easier. Okay. Dear Ab. A-B. The Heart Sutta, can we discuss it? It is such a lovely chant, encouraging way us to cultivate compassion and mercy for all living beings. And the last line breaks my heart. Why do we cultivate compassion to all who are suffering and then abandon them, leaving them here in suffering? It seems very unkind and self-serving. Please help me understand. You don't leave people. A lot of time, even like the Buddha. The Buddha, enlightened one, then he taught for 45 years, and then he entered Parinirvana. He left everybody. Did he? In those 45 years, the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, taught so powerfully that he created so many more enlightened monks and enlightened nuns and faithful lay followers, and they taught somebody else, and they taught somebody else, and they taught somebody else, and that's continued for over 2,500 years. And now you can hear it here in Bodhinyana Monastery in China Grove, Perth, and many other places as well. The way the Dhamma continues on is not just through one person. It continues on through the Sangha. The Sangha is the teacher, not one person. And please, if you really respect me, never ever take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma and Ajahn Brahm. Never do that. That's where you start cults. The Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. You depersonalize the teacher from the teachings. The teacher is the vehicle. And after a while, when I get very old, decrepit, when you hear the same old jokes again and again and again, then you hand over the teaching to the next. Who's the senior here? It's Melissa, isn't it? Where is she? It doesn't matter. The teacher will come to her. And they carry on. People might leave you behind, but the Dhamma never leaves. And that's the beautiful thing about it. That's how Buddhism continues on. Just the Buddha called it like the wheel of the Dhamma, and the wheel becomes unstoppable. Please, a message to my companions in cottage 6. Oh. Last night, I woke in the middle of the night. Wow. To someone saying very loudly, "What a wonderful place." It was me. I woke myself up talking in my sleep. I'm sorry if I disturbed you. Cottage number 6. Did anyone hear that? No? Okay. Anyway. If no one can do meditation, would you say the Anapanasati Sutta is not so much a set of instructions, but more like a description of what happens when mindfulness of breathing is developed? That's pretty good. Were the Catholic mystics you mentioned, who were able to experience jhana, able to experience the last 4 steps of Anapanasati? No. If not, then it's not entirely an automatic nature process, is it? Yes, it still is. But what one needs is like the words of another. You know, to hear it from a Buddha, hear it from an enlightened one, so that you get brainwashed. And when you get into these jhanas, you have some understanding of what they really are. You know, to me, it's quite obvious just how a Christian mystic, if they can get into that jhana, they would feel it is union with God. Why? Number one, you're not there. Your sense of self has gone. Your will is just so reduced to almost nothing. And it's the biggest bliss you've ever had in your life. What I was always fascinated by is the bliss is sometimes perceived not just as pleasure or happiness, but as pure love. Because, you know, the purity of that love, it is blissful. And sometimes you can't distinguish between really pure love and the bliss, and the sheer pleasure of it. So I can understand why. Sort of someone who's been trained, brought up, seeped in, say, Christianity, would experience that wonderful state and call it union with God. But then what happens? You come out of that first jhana, and then you go deeper, you go into a second jhana. Are there two gods? The first jhana and the second jhana are totally different. It's even more bliss. It's like this simile. You're walking up in the mountains, and eventually you climb the highest peak in the mountain range, and you're at the top. And only when you're at the top you find there's another peak higher. And you get to the second peak, which is much higher, then you find there's another one, which is higher still. It's like, you know, you've got into one of these jhanas and it's one of the, well, it is the biggest bliss you've ever experienced. You think there can't be more than this. But you carry on meditating and there is. The second jhana bliss exceeds the first jhana bliss enormously. And then you wonder how many more of these there are. You look in the books, there's a couple of more peaks to go yet. The third jhana and the fourth jhana. When you experience one of those, you know, there's more of these? It kind of blows your mind. So that's actually not hearing those teachings is one of the reasons why a person will, you know, they experience the real thing, but they're misinterpreting it. Anyway, that's what one does. Dear Ajahn, my daughter is struggling with a panic disorder. I'm trying to help her manage her fears. It often means falling to sleep with her and then starting over in the morning. It has been a heavy lift lately and I have often felt like there is not enough of me and I want to hide under the covers a bit. It becomes hard to find the energy sometimes to do the things I know will help, like meditate, because of the desire to sort of collapse in bed. Any thoughts or advice would be lovely. Much metta and appreciation. Okay, how to overcome panic disorders. Some of you know this because it was one of these beautiful byproducts of knowing how to meditate and some of the insights which come from the meditation. Because one thing which I noticed that every emotion, especially very strong emotions like panic, anxiety, fear, you may know what they feel like in your mind, kind of, but even that is just because it's an unpleasant, very agitated attack in your mind. You don't know it that well. But every one of those emotional disorders has a corresponding feeling, physical feeling, in the body. And I will now sort of demonstrate how this works. There was this lady, it's a Thai girl, but she'd been born in Australia and was more Australian than Thai. And she was studying in Adelaide University. And she had a chronic anxiety disorder, so bad that she had to stay in bed 24/7. And because she was at university, she had, you know, free medical care, psychological care, psychiatric care, but no one was able to solve her problem. And because of that, because she was, parents were Thai, and her father lived over here in Perth. And so her father came to see me and said, can you help my daughter? She's really struggling. So it was during the range retreat. I said, I can't travel to Adelaide, but she can give me a telephone call. So she called me, and then she's very smart. So I asked her, when you have a panic attack, where do you feel it in your body? And she replied, in my chest. No, I want accurate descriptions of where it is in your chest. From your belly button, from your navel, give me coordinates, centimetres above to the centre of the feeling in your chest. You know, and how big is it? Is it, you know, centred there and spread out over your chest? Give me centimetres. Now, she was a scientist, being a dentist. I want to know exactly, you know, where that feeling is in your chest. What I was doing, I knew she had nothing to do just being in bed all the time. I was teaching her mindfulness. I'm giving her a little test. Where is it located? I said, give me a call 3 days later, which she did. She gave this accurate description of where it is and how it sometimes grew, how it sometimes shrunk. I said, wonderful. Now, exactly how does it feel? You know, the sensations in your chest, are they burning sensations, contracting, stretching, aching? Does it pulse or is it just always even? Is it worse down the bottom or at the top or to the side? I want to know a really good description, not just that it hurts. Call me in 3 days' time. And that's what she did. And I was really quite impressed. She had nothing else to do and she trusted me. So she gave me this incredible description when she has a panic attack, exactly how it feels in the different parts of her body and how it grows and how it disappears and exactly where it's located. Marvellous. Now the third part of the solution. Now you can actually be mindful of the panic attack and how it manifests on your physical body. Now I want you to take your hand and massage that area, the whole area, not just part of it, the whole area. Massage it with as much kindness as you possibly can. And because she was bedridden, she was being looked after by her boyfriend, Lloyd. And he was doing everything for her, you know, washing, cooking, and making sure she had everything she needed. An amazing guy. And I said, if you can't massage your chest, ask Lloyd, your boyfriend. I think he would probably approve of doing that for you. Okay. And then 3 days later, call again, and she did. And then there was a beautiful, what we call the light bulb moment, the eureka moment. Because she said, I did it. What happened? Now, when you were massaging that area of your chest, what happened to that feeling which you described so perfectly to me? What happened to it? I said, when I massaged it long enough, the physical feeling just got less and less and less until it totally vanished. It disappeared. And that's when I said, and what happened to your anxiety? And I saw there was silence for a few minutes. Not for a few minutes, that's a bit long, for about a minute. There was silence. And then she said, the anxiety disappeared too. Great. Now you know what to do. And I hung up. I wanted to enjoy that moment of understanding from her own experience how to overcome the anxiety. Don't try and understand it, attack it, suppress it on the mental level. Every one of these emotions has a physical counterpart. Massage, get to know it first of all. Be really mindful so you really know it, understand it, where it is and how it changes and what the feelings are like. Once you have enough mindfulness, then add the kindness. Just a simple massage. And then the whole physical feelings go, and so do the emotional feelings as well. She was out of bed in a week or two, back to university. She got first class honours in dentistry. And of course, Lloyd proposed to her. There was one condition of the marriage. They had to be done in Perth. And Ajahn Brahm had to give the blessing for them. And in the meantime, she never told me this. She was so impressed. She said, you saved my life. And so she nominated me for Australian of the Year. I never got it, but it was a very nice, sweet gesture. And so now she's got about 3 kids. I think one of them came the other day to a monastery, I think on Sunday, and very happily married. She gets anxiety, she knows exactly what to do with it. Know where it's manifesting on the body and massage it. And it goes. It's not just for her. There's one of these other ladies who's a doctor here in Perth. And she had a patient with severe anxiety, so much that she couldn't breathe and was on oxygen. And apparently she told me that as a doctor in a hospital, that her job was to, well, here's the first medication, you try this one and see if it works. That one didn't work. Went down all the list of medications. And the last one she gave also never worked. So she ran out of medications to give this poor lady who has got this anxiety. And so she said, I shouldn't have done this, but I was a bit sort of tired, stressed out after a long, busy day. So I told her, try the Ajahn Brahm method. Now, where's it manifested in your body? Massage that very quickly. And then she went home. When she went to the hospital the next morning, the lady had the mask off. She said, I feel fine now, I'm going home. It worked. And I was really so pleased that, you know, that I scolded the doctor, why didn't you do that at the beginning? I said, I can't, I get fired. You know, doctors have to report what they do, and this is the standard way of doing things. So anyway, so that's how to overcome panic attacks. And so you can actually have a bit of freedom when your daughter doesn't have panic attacks anymore. Remember those three things. It's great that you take control of your own treatments. Gives you something to do. So you're not just a passive victim of some psychological disease. You know, you find out where you feel it. Really mindful of it. And then when you're aware of it, then you can give it loving kindness. A nice massage. It's nice actually massaging my tummy. I haven't got any anxiety, but it feels good. Dear Ajahn Brahm, do we get a free will when at a kindfulness moment? Please talk more about kindfulness. When we at a kindfulness, don't understand that. Do we get a free will? At a kindfulness moment? No, you don't need any will. When you're kindful, everything is going really well. What do you want to change anything for and disturb it with a will? I kind of don't understand that question, I think. If you want to sort of add to it later on, when I'm not here, when no one is here, then please do so. Next question. Oh, going well. Ooh, am I? I don't know. Oh, crikey, a hole. This is a whole sort of page or something. Anyway. Dear Ajahn, the lady with the psychotic episode, which one was that? They're quite common. They're not really psychotic episodes. Anyway, the lady with the psychotic episode, as the result of her so-called psychosis, had the sanity, mental health and clarity of mind to come to Bodhinyana and Jhana Grove, even if she could only stay for two or few hours, as you say. Most so-called high-functioning members of society will never in their whole lives step foot ever near Bodhinyana or Jhana Grove. Does this not make that lady more sane? I like that argument. That sane and mentally well than almost all other people. You've got a good point there. Was her stay at the monastery a great cause of merit and well-being for her mind, heart, body, nervous system and brain? Yeah. And can you please comment on the meritorious impact of her free-flowing effort? Is that a very bad karma to do such a thing to such a sweet and kind, loving monk such as yourself? I'm not quite sure. I sometimes I might read it wrong. But eventually, that's always my feeling, that if somebody is going through any type of psychosis, just to be kind to them. If you really know what kindness is, then they will never harm you. I already mentioned about boys throwing stones at me and just go walking towards them. They're the ones that get scared. And, you know, just the kindness. There was one occasion, I'm remembering some of the events of my life here. We were just purchased our centre in Nolamara, and we wanted to make an opening ceremony for it. And we wrote a letter to the governor of Western Australia. It was a fellow called Sir Gordon Reid. Those who live in Perth, they named the Reid Highway after him. He's a very nice guy, and we were really surprised that we're only a small society. He came. That was amazing. He was coming to our ceremony. And I'm just going to remember exactly where I was going with this. That's right. And so we didn't have that much money, but, you know, we were told, please, you know, get proper seats and a marquee, you know, for the event. And that was my job, to organise that. So I got this hire company in Dalkeith. That was a very posh suburb of Perth. And to get some big marquee, some tents, some VIP chairs and stuff. And so they came, and I was busy helping somebody else. I kind of assumed, we said we want the very best. We've got the governor and his wife coming the next day. And so they put the tent up, and it was filthy. It like it had been in some sort of farm show, you know, in remote countryside West Australia. There's lots of red dust all over it. It's not what I expected, but we got our hoses out and we hosed down that tent marquee. And then we looked at the chairs. The chairs were all dirty. So I got all the volunteers with rags to wipe down the chairs, to clean them. But then we had the VIP chairs, about 10 of them or a dozen of them. And this was no joke, no exaggeration. Not one of the chairs had legs the same length. They all wobbled. And I said, that's something you can't hose down or fix. We got the governor of Western Australia, that's a big VIP, coming the next day. And so I got on the telephone and got the manager of this hire company. She was just closing up the office a Friday afternoon. And I said, do you remember I asked for the best? And you weren't really so concerned about the cost. And what you sent over here is, no, we can't use this. We've got the governor, Sir Gordon Reid, and his wife coming tomorrow. Can you please change them? And, you know, she said, I'm terribly, terribly sorry. Yes, I remember your call. There's been some mistake. We'll have them changed straight away. What I didn't know, all the workers had knocked off work. It was the weekend. So they were all down the pub, starting their evening drinking. And so the manager of the hire company came into the pub, apparently, they told me afterwards, came into the pub and said, men, the Buddhists need the chairs changed. These workers were not happy. In fact, they were really angry. But they didn't have a choice. So they had to get back, you know, into the office, get some proper chairs, load them into the van, and then drive them to Nolamara. And this time I said, I have to be here to make sure they give proper chairs. And they were turning down Nansen Way. They'd only got halfway down Nansen Way, still travelling at speed. And then one of the men jumped out of the truck, and was still travelling quite fast, jumped out of the truck and came running towards our temple with his fist up like this. I want the bloke in charge. Where's the bloke in charge? He was angry. He'd been drinking. And he had to go back to work. That was too much for him. So I went up to him and I said, I am the bloke in charge. And he put his fist right in front of my face. And his eyes were like red, like, you know those yuccas they have, those really evil spirits in the suttas? And as he breathed, that was the most alcohol I've ever breathed in since becoming a monk. You couldn't avoid it, just breathing. He had his fist in front of me. And one thing I noticed, that all these devout Buddhists who were supposed to be looking after their monks, they did absolutely nothing. They were all standing there watching what's going to happen. He had his fist in front of me. But you know that being a meditator, it's amazing just, you know, what the mind can do. There was no fear there at all in me. And I know, because I had no fear and I was really peaceful and kind, I wasn't being over the top nice. I didn't try and talk with him, I just looked at him with kindness. And he was frozen. He couldn't do anything. He couldn't move. Because usually, if you're going to have a fight, you know, you do something like, you know, for want of a better word, for the foreplay. You know, yeah, yeah, yeah! And I didn't do that, I just looked at him. And I had the feeling, I think it was pretty accurate, I had him totally under my control. He couldn't leave, he couldn't do anything, no way he could punch me. And then in that time, the truck had parked, and the other men came out, the boss came out, and put his hand over this man's shoulder and said, come on, we'll unload the van. And I said, yeah, I'll help you. And that was the end of any conflict. It was actually quite amazing how it happened. No way could he punch me, because I wasn't playing the introductory game. So that is actually, sometimes you have some kind of conflict, but you can diffuse it very easily. The same with, he was like drunk and angry, psychotic people. You know, just, you're kind to him, you can be psychotic if you will. I allow you to be psychotic, just come in. Poor fellow, don't know, or poor lady, what you've been through, I can understand maybe a little bit why you're psychotic. You don't have to change. The door of my heart is open to you as you are. Come in. Because you don't react, they relax and they're at peace. But the problem with that is, oh my goodness, there was this other guy. He was a very interesting character who came to our city centre in the first year I was here. And he was Irish, and he knocked on the door of the city centre because he was a pest exterminator. He was spraying the pests. And so he knocked on our door and said, do you need any pests exterminated? He was looking for work. And then the other monk, Ajahn Chakra, said, no, we don't exterminate pests. We're Buddhists. Really? Why? And they had this really long conversation. And he started coming to our temple. He was really interested. You know, he wanted to get some business and said he got a religion. He was really, he's a very intelligent guy. But then what happened to him, one day he was fixing his roof and he fell off the roof, hit his head, and he became a little bit psychotic. Poor fellow. It can't happen these days, but it happened to him. And he would dress up like Elvis Presley, you know, with the shades and did his hair that way. You know, he went a bit crazy. And he came over to our temple, Nolamara. He had a walking stick. And then he was going psychotic. And he was using that walking stick and trying to hit me. But he kept on missing. I knew he wasn't really trying to hit me, just to get me scared, get some attention, for about an hour. And I was just sitting down, talking to him nicely, with his walking stick. Missed my head, missed my ears, missed everything. Never hit me once. And from that day on, there was a bond of trust between him and me. And sometimes his wife would call up and said, he's having a psychotic episode, can you just talk to him? And I could always, because he trusted me, I could always calm him down. And this one time, his wife called me, he's having another psychotic episode, can you just say a few words to him? But at that time, I had the flu. I was laying and I couldn't speak to anybody. I said, look, and I was really sort of no energy at all. This was many years ago. And I was laying in the bed there, just have a fever and just really out of it, as I couldn't talk to him. And I found out when I sort of got better that later on, an hour later, he committed suicide. He was that psychotic. But I knew that if I could have not had that flu, I could have talked to him and just calmed him down. But I never felt guilty about that. I always remember it because there's no way I could talk to him. But nevertheless, he's extremely so disturbed. But because of the trust which we had together, there's no way he would ever have done anything to hurt me or hurt himself. It's amazing just how much connection you have with a person if you know what kindness is. Anyway, dear Ajahn, when we pray to Buddha during chanting, who are we praying to? Does he exist somewhere? What's the purpose of bowing, praying to Buddha statue other than bowing to his Dhamma? Can you bow and pray to other enlightened beings? You know, that's one of the problems in Australia. People don't like bowing to anything. And they think that's submissive. That's taking a culture which people can understand in Asia. Why do we have to do that in Australia? Why do we have big Buddha statues here? What do they mean? You know, what? So, the way I explain that was the story. Okay, last story. I think I just kept my end up. I don't think I made much progress, but... Oh, we didn't fall behind. It's the last story here. This over here in Perth was one of the Catholic, one of the Anglican schools. It's Christ Church Grammar School. It's this beautiful site overlooking the Swan River. I really don't know why they haven't sold it, because they get a fortune for that place. It's delightful views, but it's one of the private schools, very high fees. But anyway, they have a chaplain there. That was Father Frank Sheehan. And because I was helping out with the Cancer Support Association, he went there to help out too. We became associated. And so he said, why don't you come to our school to give a talk? At least you talk some sense, not like some of the other people who give these talks there. So I said, okay, I'll go there. And so I had to arrive very early in the morning, you know, before the school started. And when I got there, you know, I was waiting outside with Frank, the chaplain, and with the principal. And the principal was a very strict, well-known Christian, Anglican. Because to be the principal of that school, you couldn't just be any old teacher. You know, it was one of the Anglicans' main schools in Perth, the Anglican community. So I was waiting outside while the kids were getting settled in the assembly hall. And the principal said, this is an Anglican, it's a Christian school. It's not a Buddhist school. So we have a little statue of Jesus inside. And it's our custom that when we go inside, we will do a little bow to Jesus. You're a Buddhist, you don't have to do that. I think you know what's coming next. I've said this many times. That got my rebellious spirits up. And I looked at the principal and said, I demand my right to bow to your statue of Jesus. I had a point to make. And the principal was really quite shocked. You know, the chaplain, Frank Sheehan, he knew me so well. He said, no. You know, he's not a crazy monk. And so I explained to him, I said, you know, I would like to do this. There's something in that statue there which reminds me of something beautiful. That's what I'm going to bow to. And that became the talk when I talked to the kids inside the school. And so we have these big Buddha statues, you know, all over the place. When I bow to them, I don't bow to a lump of metal. I bow to what it means to me. And my first bow is usually to virtue. I love virtue. It's meant so much to me. You know, you can trust people. They become friends. And you can make a much better world where we don't have to worry about locking the doors, you know, at night time. We know no one's going to do any harm to us. We can, you know, leave something here at night, and which is very valuable, and we don't have to worry that somebody's going to steal it. Because we trust each other. That virtue is beautiful. So my first bow is to virtue, because I worship virtue. I put my head low. It's like putting something on top of my head. And this is how much I worship virtue. And my second bow is to peace. Because peace is, in meditation, once you understand what peace is, it's gorgeous. It's really inspiring when you have peace right in front of you. And because you're mindful, it doesn't move, it's just there. You just let your mind sink into that peace. It's so healthy, so, okay, holy, so wonderful. And it's not just peace by itself, it becomes peace in your monastery, peace in your retreat center, peace in your family, peace in your community, peace in your body. Everyone thinks starts to work in harmony together. It'd be great if you can get that peace in the whole world. It just, I don't know what the benefits are, but it's a beautiful thing to see, like a flower in bloom. So my second bow is to peace. I raise it above myself. I'm not important, but peace is. And my third bow is to... It used to be to wisdom, compassion, but now I just do it to compassion. Kindness. Because when you see real acts of kindness, and then somebody just goes out of their way and way beyond what they should ever do to help somebody else, that kindness, that compassion, is just a beautiful glow in this world. And every time you see something like that, it inspires you, makes the world a beautiful place to be in. So that compassion is my third bow. Because I worship compassion. What it does to me is every time I bow, I remember those three things. They're important, I can never forget them. I bow to them. It's fun to worship something which is really worth worshipping. Virtue, peace and compassion. And all the kids, especially the headmaster, understood that. And he understood why the Buddhists bow now. He was so impressed that he arranged very quickly a visit by the school to Bodhinyana Monastery. And he came as well. And he actually arrived earlier than the bus carrying the school kids. You know those school kids, they wanted to visit my cave where I live. So only a few could come in at a time. And when they came in and I closed the door and turned the lights down, their comment was, and they're about 15 or 16 or 17-year-olds, they say, this will be a great place for a rave. So, but anyway, when the principal arrived early in the rest, I took him into our main hall in Bodhinyana Monastery, the big Buddha statue there. And the two of us, next to each other, we bowed three times to peace, virtue, sorry, to virtue, peace and compassion. And I was just kind of gobsmacked the very fact that this very senior Anglican could bow three times to the Buddha. He wasn't really bowing to the Buddha, he was bowing to what the Buddha meant. Like I could bow to a statue of Jesus. I can always see something in there which I really could worship. That's why we bow to a Buddha statue. That's why we do chanting. Because things like virtue, peace and compassion are really beautiful. That's what it symbolizes. Okay, I've gone over time again. It's almost 10 to 9 now. So thank you all for listening. And who knows, I might go a bit more. But you know, sometimes I think you don't have to finish the questions. I think as long as the quality of the answers, the extra stuff you mentioned is important, that's good enough. Is that okay? Do you agree? Yeah, okay. And if your question wasn't answered, remember the reason why. Because your karma is not good enough. Okay. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Oh my goodness.